want to begin with our customary but not rote land acknowledgement. Here's a question around this matter of shared land that came to me this week. If we're not Indigenous, and most of us in this community are not all of us, but most of us, if we are not Indigenous, if that's not our tradition, our history, our people group, do we really think that the fully formed societies that already existed on this continent before the arrival of European settlers had no imagined future that looked better to them than their present? Do we really think that the peoples that were on this continent never thought about the future with an eye to making their world better before the Europeans arrived and said, here's your better future. We know what it looks like. And we can compel you in that direction. If we do think that, or even if we operate as though we do without ever really having considered the question, I think all we have to do to give our head a shake about it is pay even brief attention to the ways in which many contemporary Indigenous leaders are referencing the words of their elders as regards both our present tense experiences and the future. Indigenous wisdom, and again, I know I'm not in the lane of my tradition, so this is at a distance, and I gratefully acknowledge that these things are shared with the whole culture for anyone who wants to pay attention. Indigenous wisdom from the distant past, from before the arrival of settlers, is full of pictures of a better future, and also of what happens to a future if we ignore the lessons of the past. And we're going to explore that idea generally more as we go today, but I wanted to mention it as part of the context for our land acknowledgement today, and also because if you listen to contemporary Indigenous leaders, you will hear this wisdom being referenced. It was there. It is there. I think this is part of our shared human legacy. This is a thing we do. It's like meaning making. Imagining a better future for ourselves and for those we love seems to be pretty nearly built in, pretty much hardwired for us. And when we start to lose our grip on that, we suffer. I had a conversation with a dear friend this week who's a grandfather and who's, I think this is his oldest grandchild, is 13. And struggling with questions like, why am I alive? What am I doing here? Big existential questions for one so young. And wrestling with their mental health as a result. I wish that was an isolated story, but it isn't. When we lose our grip on imagining a better world, and the possibility that we might participate in the making of such a thing, it beats us up. Long way around, I know. But part of the context, for me at least today, gratefully acknowledging that we gather as a community on Treaty One land. We gather on a part of the continent that was already filled with dreams of a better future when European settlers got here. We're all still here, and we're figuring out how to live together better. That's part of that better world. I believe that, and I want to continue to participate in it. Let's take a few moments to breathe together, and also kind of right down there at the bottom of our shared human legacy is breath and life. So let's pause and not just remember that that's the case, but participate in that physically as well as mentally and emotionally. So let's do 5 rounds this morning in through our noses for a count of 3 or whatever fills you all the way up. Cradle your breath like your baby, like one you love, for a count of 3 and then all the way out for a count of 6. I mention the counts because they help me. They may not help you. You may choose to not participate in this at all. As I've said before, Just in case we have any guests this morning or new to the community folks watching this, this is a regular practice, but it's not an obligation. It's a way to enter a shared space, and you're welcome to participate or not as you feel comfortable and are able to do so. So, five rounds, breathe together, and know that we are doing this, many of us, at the same time. And that's a real kind of connection, even though it's a hard one to explain sometimes or to even experience sometimes. All right. That's a lot of talk. Let's breathe. Here we go. Peace, everybody. Thank you. It's good to be alive with you all. Sometimes, in a world of internet wormholes, sometimes you do have a moment that sticks with you. It can feel a little bit like finding a diamond in the trash, or maybe sort of more practically like finding, you know, a crumpled 20 in your jeans. Hey, look, excellent. Kind of like that. I had a moment like that recently. I was watching an interview with a Black American jazz musician, a woman named Esperanza Spalding. If you know who that is, then you're probably already kind of going, oh yeah, I know about Esperanza Spalding. If you don't, this woman is a bass player, a singer, an arranger, a band leader, a force of creative energy. She is smart. She is well educated. She's a spiritually highly attenuated person. She's what my grandfather would have called a going concern. She kind of rippled the pop culture waters in 2011 when she won a Grammy for Best New Artist, beating out Justin Bieber, which the Biebs fans found very confusing. Anyway, she has since won three more Grammys, including a 2020 Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Album for her newest release, which is called 12 Little Spells. Anyway, before I get, you know, all fanboy about this, one of the things that she said in this interview was about her activism, and in particular, her activism as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. She was quoting somebody else in the interview. I don't remember who she quoted, and I didn't take the time to go look it up. But I was so struck by the quote that I made a note about it, and I pinned it to my desktop, which is not something I typically do when I'm online. What she said that totally stopped my tracks is she said, "All activism is speculative fiction. All activism is speculative fiction." I'm not sure I remember what most of the rest of the interview was about, because that just launched me. It might help to touch a little bit on what speculative fiction is, because I know we don't all, you know, run around all the time talking about genres of literature. So let me just read you a short definition, and then I'm going to unpack it a bit. I should just say before I read that definition, personally, I don't care if you never care about speculative fiction. That is not the point. I think as a literary genre, it's delightful and it can be good for us as humans, but I think there's something bigger at stake here, and that's what I'm after. So stay with me. Here's the definition, though, by way of an entry point. Speculative fiction is a broad category of fiction encompassing genres with certain elements that do not exist in terms of the recorded history and observed phenomena of the current universe, covering various themes in the context of the supernatural, futuristic, and many other imaginative topics. The critical part of that definition for our purposes this morning is that it's a genre with certain elements that do not exist in terms of the recorded history and observed phenomena of the current universe. That's the critical bit of the definition. So by way of trying to, you know, think about what that might be, if you wanted some familiar examples, that they would range from classic works like George Orwell's 1984 or Herbert's Dune novels. More recent works would include things like Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, or her Orcs and Crake novel, or the novel behind a popular movie like The Martian. Those are all works that would fall into the genre of speculative fiction. So, what does all this have to do with activism? And beyond that, what is the connection to our everyday lives and to what we're doing here together this morning, what we do at the table, which is exploring what we believe? There's probably lots of ways we could engage with that. I'm going to pick the avenue of the importance of imagination in working toward a better world. When someone sits down to write speculative fiction, one of their tasks, and this seems a little obvious when you say it, like lots of important things, one of their tasks is world making. Not literal world making, fictional world making, the making of worlds in their imagination. They are making a place, places in many instances, in which certain elements that do not exist in terms of recorded history and observed phenomena of the current universe exist. They're making those kind of worlds. And then what they're doing is they're taking this world that they've imagined and they are unspooling the implications of those sorts of things existing. They are speculating about what the world might look like, how the world might work if they did. And sometimes they're imagining things that are good and lovely. Sometimes they're imagining things that are terrible and apocalyptic. Everything in between. Spalding, in the interview, was referencing a powerful contemporary movement toward a world in which black lives matter to the same degree that white lives matter. That is not a world that she, as a black woman, or any of us, lives in at the moment. That's not what recorded history shows us. And it's not what we observe if we look at the world around us. But it could be, if enough of us imagine it and then work together to move toward that reality. If we can't imagine it, if we aren't willing to speculate about it, we won't move toward it. Bumper sticker version, no imagination, no action. And this is true in all sorts of categories of imagination, including an important category behind any movement that has to do with issues of justice, which is a category that I've touched on before recently that I would call moral imagination. If we don't have a moral imagination, if we're not willing to try to envision a moral future that is in better repair than the moral present, then we're not going to work toward it. Let me give you some examples, because again, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, this word moral can be a sticking point sometimes because of ways in which it gets misapplied, I would say, fairly vigorously and fairly often. So ideas that need some kind of grounding in moral imagination if they're going to be robust enough to actually function would include ideas like this. Ideas like love your neighbor. Ideas like love the stranger, or hear the cry of the otherwise unheard. Make the effort to hear that cry. Liberate the poor from their poverty. Care for the dignity of all. If you have more than you need, share your blessings with those who have less. Feed the hungry. House the homeless. Heal the sick in body and mind. Fight injustice, whoever it is done by and whoever it is against, and so on. Those are moral ideas. We do these sorts of things because we are bound together by a covenant of human solidarity, regardless of our color, our culture, our class, or our creed. And we do them because we are willing to try to imagine, because we are willing to speculate about how we might move toward a world in which they exist, as distinct from the world we are in now, where they may not, or in which they may take a form that needs to continue to be unfolded. It's pretty easy, easier for some of us than others. I can be pretty distracted, so this resonates for me maybe especially, but it's pretty easy to be fully occupied with our present realities, what's right in front of us. And for some of us, again, personalities come into play, circumstances come into play, certainly. But for some of us, that's the view of the world that kind of has all our lights on, is the one that we're in right at the moment. And that can be a real gift, being able to be in the moment. It can also mean that there are things that are not in the moment that just whoosh, just zoom by. Or if we went to the other end of the spectrum, so to speak, we might be perennially distracted. We live in a world that makes that very possible. We can click once and not come up for air for hours, for instance. So, you know, we could miss the present by being always drawn away and everything in between. But that list of things that we need to attend to, love your neighbor, so on, those things are moral principles. They are not economic principles. They are not political ones. Now, is there intersections? Absolutely. That's sort of not what we're talking about today, but for sure. But those are all things that have to do at their core with conscience, not as directly with wealth and power. In other words, one of the first places those things exist is in our minds, in our imaginations, rather than in the marketplace or in the halls of power. They don't start there. They start in our imagination. They exist the way a thing like liberty exists. Free market capitalism, liberal democracy, both so familiar that they're like the air we breathe in this culture, they may deliver many things that we experience as good. I would not, for instance, have wanted to go through this pandemic without much of what has been brought into being by way of technology, by those things. But even though things like free market capitalism and liberal democracy can deliver some things that are good, those are not things that will save liberty, for instance, because liberty is something that cannot be built by self-interest and self-interested activities alone. History, one of the big thematic lessons of history is that I-based societies all die, and other-based societies survive. Very broad stroke, I realize, and yet I think defensible. Without some sort of shared moral imagination, that list of moral principles, that love your neighbor, love the stranger, hear the cry of the other, rise unheard, those sorts of things, that list will not continue to be engaged with and enacted unless we exercise our moral imagination. Let's bring that a little closer to home. We're watching some of this idea be enacted all around us every day in this pandemic. So we already had an epidemic of isolation that was increasingly defining our culture before the pandemic hit. And then when it hit, we saw some interesting iterations. We saw that it is selfless behavior that allows life to continue, that the self-restraint we're having to practice for the safety of others is essential. We crashed headlong into the realization that many of the heroes of this time are among the lowest paid people in our societies. We experienced the challenge of political leadership in a time of crisis. We encounter on a daily basis the importance of truth-telling as a condition of public trust. All of these are moral issues, and the ways that we're engaging with them in this unprecedented time shines a light, sometimes a rather troubling one, on our collective capacity to imagine better ways to live wisely. Now, one way to examine this is to contrast the behaviors that accompany I-driven behavior in contrast to we-driven behavior. So, just a couple of, for instances, to get our imagination stirred about this. When it's all about me, panic buying leaves the most vulnerable even more in danger. When it's all about me, when I put my convenience or preferences ahead of the needs of others, my disregard of social distancing measures and isolation directives puts others at risk. In the case of COVID, it places the greatest burden most heavily on those least equipped to carry it. You know, this challenging idea that going to a party or an event or refusing to wear a mask is, quote, exercising my freedom, close quote. What that idea does is it leaves unaddressed the idea that we have no right to freedom if exercising that right harms the freedom of others. Liberal democracy, the sort of air we breathe, politically speaking, in a liberal democracy, the idea of freedom is collective. And as such, it depends on self-restraint. We sure like the idea of freedom. We tend to get rubbed the wrong way by self-restraint. A society in which everyone is free to do what they want is not, in fact, a free society. Arguably, it's not a society at all. It is, by definition, anarchy. Anarchy is an interesting word. It's complex. Like lots of powerful words, it started out meaning simply the absence of government. That's sort of its core technical meaning. But then 16th century, huge revolutions and civil disorder And so it kind of got applied to that. So it kind of took that drift for a while. And then by the 19th century, it was more commonly taken to include this utopian idea of a society that does not require a government. And these days it's sort of settled into something broadly meaning a state of confusion or disorder. And so I think by almost any of those definitions, reasonably applied to the idea of everyone being free to do whatever they want. And these days we can see the enacting of that not workable for the collective idea of freedom in stark contrast to the inspiration of people that are prepared to work for or sacrifice for the good of others. And we all have our own list, I'm sure, and I sincerely hope that there are individuals that you know and love on your list, if you're not actually one of those people yourself, and many people at the table certainly would be, but common list for most of us would include healthcare personnel, would include people that keep essential services going, delivery drivers, it would include teachers, it would include people that are daily placing the common good over self-interest. But to work or to make personal choices that put someone else's needs ahead of my own requires imagination. It requires envisioning a world that we don't live in every day. Here's a question, because maybe we didn't have enough of them yet this morning. When this is over, this being the pandemic, do you think we'll learn any larger lessons from it? Or do you think we'll just try to get things back to the way things were as quickly as we can? Put it another way, will we have changed or merely endured? Will the pandemic turn out to be a transformation of history or just an interruption? German philosopher G.W.F. Hegel believed that the rational alone is real. For him, that meant that all reality is capable of being expressed in rational categories. For Hegel, life was head first. Maybe it was head only. Some days I think about ideas like Hegel's and I want to be the organizer of a TED Talks event and get him and Brené Brown or somebody like that to do back-to-back TED Talks. Anyway, Hegel famously said that the only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. Great. So we can probably figure out where he would come down on that question of how we might behave on the other side of this pandemic, let alone the importance of what I've been calling moral imagination. Now, in what might initially seem like sort of a subtle contrast, philosopher, essayist, poet, and novelist George Santayana said, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." It might sort of sound like they're saying the same thing, but they're not. Santayana is an interesting figure for lots of reasons, not the least of which is that he was an atheist, but he treasured the Spanish Catholic values, worldview, and practices in which he was raised. And so an atheist whose core imagination about the world was deeply informed by visions of the future that were built on the idea that there is something more powerful going on here that is good, for instance. So I can't help but wonder how those values informed his imagination when it came to something like the question of the role of our perspective on history and what sort of impact that has on our present and future choices. Because from where I sit, it looks like what Hegel's idea that we don't learn anything from history, what Hegel's idea does is it slams the hope door shut. And what Santayana's idea that does, the idea that we can learn from the past, but if we don't, we're going to repeat ourselves, that door, that idea feels like it keeps the hope door cracked open, you know? It feels like Santayana's idea says there's more going on in our human behavior and our choices than can be accounted for by the rational alone. In other words, what we can imagine matters just as much as what we can experience or what we can measure. We could even argue that what we can imagine matters more because of the power with which it informs what we may or will experience in the future. A little while ago, we touched briefly on the idea that one way to think about what it means to be human is to understand ourselves as the animal that learns. If we let something as sweeping as this pandemic go by, and we only regard it as a deeply inconvenient interruption to our preferred way of life, it's possible that we're being incredibly, maybe even fatally, short-sighted. To treat these global events that way would be to refuse to examine what got us here, how the choices we have made over time have aimed us at this moment in history, and how we can choose differently. We will, in the words of Santa Anna, be dooming ourselves to a repeat performance at some point in the future, one for which we will be no better prepared than we were for this one, unless we are willing to engage in some lively and enlivening speculation about other possible, and some might even say impossible, futures. Now, at one level, all of that can just sound ridiculous. I get that. And again, to some of us, depending on personality, experience, circumstance, so on, for some people, this set of ideas just feels like a beacon in the night. And for other people, a set of ideas like this just feels like, I think I should have pulled the covers up over my head, got some sleep instead. Not interested. Not interesting. And of course, a huge range of other experiences as well, but by way of contrast. So what I want to do, because of that reality about ideas like this, that they can strike us in so many different ways, is I want to set them into a story that is ancient, but still around. Because as I've said many times before, these are the stories we need to pay attention to as a species. This is what I was touching on when I talked about indigenous wisdom and its enduring nature over time, its ability to endure even concerted attempts to eradicate it. When stories behave like that, it's usually because, even if their context isn't our context, it's usually because they have some unique horsepower. They're tapping a deeper vein, if you will. And I think that that's very, very important for us when we are doing work of the imagination about better worlds. I should just say as well, this is the way I often approach stories that are part of the collection that we just commonly, maybe offhandedly if we grew up with it, call the Bible. I don't tend to reference them because I think that there's a thin red line from the divine to that text, any more than there's a thin red line from the divine to any other sacred text. Now, having said that, if we grew up in this tradition, we may have encountered those stories being used in many different ways, some of which have done us harm, and some of which have ceased to be believable, and some of which maybe never seemed believable in the first place, but if we were in a context where you couldn't say those things, we had to pretend we believed them until we didn't have to pretend anymore. And then we went, where's a community where I can explore what I believe? And we went to the table maybe, I don't know. But all to say, lots of us in this community don't know how to come to these stories anymore. We have of necessity or by design or by choice stepped away from them as informing our imaginations. And so when I come to them personally, I come with many of those things as part of my personal experience, but I also come to them as somebody that believes what I just said about enduring stories. We can misuse anything, including enduring stories. And so this is an attempt, I suppose, to redeem an ancient story, if you will, from what I've experienced and what many of us have experienced as misapplication or misuse. If you've been around the table any length of time, you already know that some of my favorite characters from the narratives surrounding the birth of Jesus are the Persian princes, the so-called wise men. And I like this. I like this group of characters in the story because their story is so crazy. I use the word crazy advisedly. It is, among other things, a story about a speculative venture in the extreme. It is based, if we think about the characters and their behaviors, it is based on something most of us would not regard as data, even though there might be data involved. I mean, as we have the story, this was a group of people who were in the 21st century, would they be astrologers or would they be astronomers? Well, they were a bit of both. They studied the sky as an astronomer does. They made meaning of it, more like an astrologer does these days. What they saw in the sky, the story says, compelled them to absolutely take a flyer, to just engage in a ridiculously speculative venture. What would we say that venture was based on? Was it based on a vision? Was it based on an idea? Was it based on a hope? Was it based on a disaffection about which we know nothing? What was going on underneath? I want us to think about the beginning of that story. Use our imaginations about the beginning of that story for a little bit. Because most of us, I think, imagine the greeting card version, in which there are three. Why three? We don't know from the narrative that there are three, but there are three gifts. And so we turn that into three gift givers in the telling. But there tend to be on the greeting card these three, dressed not like the other characters, men. They're usually clearly just visually portrayed as wealthy, of affluence. They are presenting gifts, you know, fit for a king. And that's how we tend to imagine the story, is that moment. Often that moment portrays Jesus as a baby, which is not match the narrative at all. Where they come to see Jesus suggests that by this point the child would have been at least two. And given what the story tells us about where they're from, they had probably been journeying for that long. And the signs they saw in the heavens told them about a birth, not a two-year-old. And so whatever this speculative venture they undertook was, I think it's fair to read the story with our imaginations engaged as 2 years of, at least, of, you know, traveling in the dark. That's a long winter. That's a long winter. And when you think about the nature of the quest and the things that are in the story, it's quite absurd, really. It's a story in which people from another culture and religion undertake this sort of hero's tale kind of adventure. It's a quest based on things they saw in the heavens, in the stars, that they read in their horoscopes. And along the way, they encounter crazy kings. They have dreams that include games with clues. They meet a poor kid that their intuition plus those clues plus their personal experience suggest to them that this is someone whose existence will alter the course of history. This is someone that was worth encountering, even if it cost you years of your life to get there. And the encounter with whom you could never really explain or justify when you got back home. I mean, what do we imagine characters in a story like this would say when 4 years later they made it back and somebody said, so? So, when I read a story like that, here's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like a storyteller's imagining of a world in which taking risks based on things that are uncertain can sometimes lead to a world in which cultures and religions can cross-pollinate, which happens in this story, in which despots sometimes lose ground to people and ideas that seem to come out of nowhere, in which poor kids from unwed moms can end up as spiritual leaders or kings in context. It's like the writer is imagining a world in which dreamers can wake up from dreams and take to the road, and that can change their lives and the lives of those around them forever. It can create stories as they go that will inspire generations to come, sometimes in ways that no one can adequately explain or account for. If we try to rein this story like this all into the realm of the rational, we will have missed the point of the story. Because what it sounds like, to me, is speculative fiction. Like an act of the imagination that paints a picture of a better world, one that welcomes us all to not confuse the rational with the real, or to confuse our now with the way things are, but to at least once in a while act on our speculation and see where it takes us. I think that's how you live a life in which you are, in fact, exploring what you believe. Feel free to disagree, of course. Peace to you all. It's been good to be with you. And I look forward to being with you again soon.